Welcome to the Paul Revere Show. This is Craig Mastantuono, attorney in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, sitting in for regular host Mark Thompson on the Paul Revere Show. Welcome to our first half of the program, and thanks for joining us, everybody. We will be joined a little bit later in the program by Wisconsin Lieutenant Governor and candidate for United States Senate, Democratic candidate Mandela Barnes, and I look forward to having a ranging discussion with Lieutenant Governor Barnes. Leading up to that, we have a little time to kill for discussion. So I wanted to relate some experiences that I've had recently in leading up to what is anticipated to be a very controversial Supreme Court opinion that's going to be released later this month or later this summer. In Dobbs versus Jackson Women's Health Organization. That is the case that was the subject of the now infamous leaked Supreme Court opinion, where Justice Alito, writing for an apparently at least five justice majority, appears set to release an opinion where the Supreme Court's going to overturn Roe versus Wade, the 1973 United States Supreme Court decision that held that a woman's choice to seek an abortion is a constitutional right under the 14th Amendment, right to privacy. And it seems like since that leaked opinion was released and reported on, there was an immediate fury and reaction and counter-reaction and discussion, and then followed by relative calm before what I think is going to be another storm when the opinion is released. So in the time that we have, and I invite our listeners to join us for part of the discussion, if time is available, our number is 844-967-2789. That's 844-967-2789. I'd like to relate some remarks that I've heard and try to pull them together into a theme that is essentially the theme being trust in our institutions and where we're at as a society moving forward. It was impossible to ignore the story if you were a young adult or an adult of the leaked opinion in Dobbs. And among the people who noticed that was my 16-year-old daughter. She is the daughter of two attorneys. My wife and I are both lawyers, and so maybe that helped with her noticing the decision. We do the leaked opinion. We do have the news on a lot. And so she asked us some questions about it. We tried as best as we could to explain what we thought this meant and what might be coming. And something stuck out in my mind very vividly as I recalled her response, which was a simple, "I don't think nine people should have that kind of power. I just don't think nine people who sit there for life should have the power to say what our rights are." It caused me, a lifelong attorney who is a player in the institution of law, to pause. My initial response was, "Hate the players, not the game," type of conversational response with my daughter. But her words resonated beyond that conversation, and it really got me thinking. The broader discussion around the leaked opinion often included reference to the fact that this is a major decision where the Supreme Court is going to be taking away rights, in effect, rather than endowing them. And that was not lost on me in the broader discussion. I remember, for example, I think going back almost 20 years now, the United States Supreme Court had an opportunity to undo Miranda versus Arizona, which is the case that requires officers to read suspects accused of crime their rights, the ones that you see on TV, the right to remain silent, the right to an attorney, the right to a publicly provided attorney. And I remember a scholar at the time, a United States Supreme Court scholar, predicting accurately that the Supreme Court would decline to do that, even though the current makeup of the court at that time was a court that would have presumably been friendly to overturning that decision. And that scholar's reasoning went like this: the Supreme Court is not going to be the court that takes away just about the only right that people know they have, the one that they see on TV, the right to be informed of their rights when they are a suspect in a criminal proceeding. And it made a rudimentary sense to me. And in fact, that decision was not overturned. And it seems now, some 20 years later, that with Roe, a woman's right to terminate a pregnancy is one that obviously the public generally knows about. And this is going to be a court that appears poised to take away rights rather than endow them, such as recent decisions, including the decision that afforded the LGBTQ community to marry members of that community. And so my daughter's remark resonated with me because I thought, you know, this is the kind of decision that causes responses like that. How can we have this institution? And when I hear one person question the very validity of one of the three branches of government in our system, it causes me pause as an attorney, as a legal officer. So that was one conversation that I had. The second category of remarks that I heard was not a conversation as much as it was a talk. I attended the American Constitution Society National Convention last week, Progressive Lawyers Association, the largest in the country. And among the speakers was United States Supreme Court Justice Sonia Sotomayor. And it was really something to be in a room with the justice, who addressed a few hundred people. And as is her custom when giving talks, she moved about the room, touching people's hands and shaking their hands under the express condition that she extracted from the audience first, that we all stay masked and keep our masks above our noses, as she disclosed that she has been watching her health very carefully and has an underlying health condition. I wanted to be very careful about that, but it was really something to watch her speak. And the other part of the agreement for the justice to speak was that she would not be discussing pending cases before the court or even indirectly referencing issues before the court. Rather, she spoke on broad themes related to her personal life and the Supreme Court as an institution as a whole. And it was extraordinary. I did get to shake the justice's hand, which was also a thrill, briefly, as she spoke. But in looking back on her remarks and that experience, I can't help but think that Justice Sonia Sotomayor was bracing this audience for what was to come. She discussed the infamous Dred Scott decision of the United States Supreme Court, which essentially held that Black people had no rights in the 1857 decision, which the white man was bound to respect as it related to the freedom of Dred Scott, who sued for his freedom after being brought to a territory which was not a slave-enforced territory. And she talked about the long struggle in history that is sometimes necessary when the people who make up our institutions make mistakes. And the duty that what she referenced as the fourth branch of government, which was the people, which is in her opinion, the people, to then respond to and engage and embrace the struggle to reassert their rights all the more. And she took a stroll through Supreme Court history, starting with Dred Scott, taking a stop at Plessy, which further enforced a separate but equal doctrine, and then landing in 1954 with the famous Brown versus Board of Education case as the ultimate reversal of those terrible prior cases and policies. And Justice Sotomayor, I think in her words of struggle, personal challenge, and the ability to move forward was in her own way warning us for what is to come and what might be a long struggle ahead of people on the side of a woman's right to choose to then re-engage that right as a lawful right in American, in our country. Lastly, during that same conference, I had the ability to listen to advocates who work on women's reproductive rights in a panel discussion. And one of the advocates works with Jane's Due Process, which is an organization in Texas. And in a wide-ranging discussion with the other panelists, she was bracing for the Dobbs decision, and which was a decision that, in her opinion, would simply make the work that they were doing in Texas to further inform and support young people seeking abortions, that work would cease, in her opinion. I'm a criminal defense attorney by trade. During my day, I represent people accused of crime in state and federal courts with two great law partners. And the woman attorney who works with Jane's Due Process talked about the anticipation that should they try to assist women, even in going to another state or securing funding to go to another state to secure an abortion, she was quite certain that criminal prosecution and attempts at criminal prosecution and law enforcement intervention would follow for she and her staff. And in a moment of almost tears, she said, "My young people, almost all of them young people of color, are people that I don't want to expose to getting arrested and being prosecuted criminally. And I know that that's going to be the next response." And as I sat in the audience, I thought to myself, well, I've been a criminal defense lawyer for 30 years, and I am often moved to try to help people, either for hire as an attorney or doing pro bono work or being asked to do work at reduced rates. And I thought to myself, is this one of those occasions where, moved by recent events in history and at the Supreme Court level, I'm going to have to evaluate whether the services of my firm and my own abilities as a lawyer are going to have to come into play to assist organizations like that one in helping them and the people that work for them avoid criminal prosecution or respond to criminal prosecution for helping secure a right that was once and still is the law of the land and a constitutional privilege. So the broader theme is trust in our institutions, how we respond to what those institutions do. We are headed into a short break. And on the other side, I would invite us to call in and perhaps share thoughts, or we'll pick up the conversation on the other side. 844-967-2789. Welcome back to the Paul Revere Show. This is attorney Craig Mastantuono sitting in for regular host Mark Thompson. And we're talking about the Supreme Court of the United States, women's reproductive rights, and the impending decision in Dobbs versus Jackson Women's Health Organization. What is anticipated to be the decision that will overturn Roe versus Wade some 50 years after a woman's choice to seek an abortion was endowed as a constitutional right in that decision under the 14th Amendment right to privacy. You know, this is going to be really different this time around from when Roe was released 50 years ago. First of all, this decision will be released on the internet. The Supreme Court will not offer the author of the lead opinion in that case to read it from the bench, nor will a dissent be read from the Supreme Court bench. For various reasons, mostly security related, the Supreme Court will not be live in court when this decision is released, unlike its the decision that it will likely overturn Roe versus Wade. There are some who are hopeful that this decision still may not be final, that the draft opinion that was leaked may not be final. I tend to be a skeptic in that regard. And I believe that this will be a momentous decision that will come and take away a very well-known right that has been accepted as law for the past 50 years. Just a quick stroll down memory lane, and Lieutenant Governor Mandela Barnes is going to be joining us for the second half of the show in just a few minutes. But a little bit of brief legal history regarding the Dobbs decision that is upcoming. When we say overturn Roe, remember that was a 1973 decision. The United States Supreme Court had not previously held that there was a right under the 14th Amendment for women to seek an abortion. But that was preceded, Roe itself was preceded by a series of cases that explored a general constitutional right to privacy, cases that included decisions, private decisions to use contraception, being the most famous example, and other decisions. And so Roe expanded on those decisions, which restricted states' rights to outlaw use of contraception, for example, in the Griswold case, to find in Roe that there was a 14th Amendment right to privacy and a woman had a choice to seek an abortion. And remember, the Roe decision imposed restrictions based on a trimester framework. And the trimester framework has been lost since then, largely. I'll talk about the Casey decision in a moment. But the Roe decision held that a state cannot impinge upon a woman's choice to seek an abortion in the first trimester of pregnancy, but that it may impose restrictions that promoted the health of the mother in the second trimester and allowed states to prohibit abortions in the third trimester after a fetus reaches the stage of what is called viability, which is the ability to survive outside the womb generally, and that is at about 24 weeks. That's really been the law and the framework since Roe, coming up on 50 years ago, was decided. There was the 1992 Casey case, where the Supreme Court reaffirmed Roe. States were given the authority to restrict abortions so long as those restrictions did not impose an undue burden on the mother. So the Supreme Court reaffirmed the right under Roe, but did also authorize state restriction as long as they were able to pass the undue burden test. And so states began enacting requirements and had previously begun enacting requirements such as counseling, informed consent, 24-hour waiting periods, and parental consent for minors. So what's at stake now is the Supreme Court is considering whether a Mississippi law that bans abortions after 15 weeks, whether that is constitutional. And remember, 15 weeks is well below the third trimester period. Or 24 weeks, which had been constitutional privilege up until that point. Under Roe, states are prohibited from banning abortion before viability or 24 weeks. So the Mississippi law is in direct contravention of that. And instead of simply upholding Mississippi's 15-week ban, which would effectively, if not explicitly overturn Roe, limit the finding of Roe, which many saw as potentially a compromise position for this now very conservative Supreme Court. The court seems poised, given the leaked opinion, to explicitly overturn Roe and Casey, returning to each state the decision of whether to allow, restrict, or ban abortion entirely. And what that means is whether abortion will be allowed, restricted, or banned will be then up to the discretion of each state's legislature. This will affect all kinds of things in all kinds of places. And it will not be an effective end to the strategy, maneuvering, advocacy around this issue. Various states will spring into various stages of either enforcing full bans or trying to secure more robustly the right of a woman to have an abortion in their respective states. The current Wisconsin abortion laws is something that we should take a look at within this discussion. Currently in Wisconsin, Roe versus Wade still standing as good law. Abortions after 21 weeks are prohibited unless medically necessary to save the life of the woman. A woman must currently meet with a counselor and physician to receive state-directed counseling and a physical examination and then wait 24 hours until she can have the procedure. Parental consent or a court-granted petition is required for a minor who seeks an abortion, and no hospital or medical personnel at authorized hospital is required to perform an abortion. That's the current law in Wisconsin, which largely fits with the Roe versus Wade framework. immediate effects in Wisconsin if Roe is overturned is lastly what we'll take a look at. There is a very old, from the 1800s, Wisconsin statute, section 940.04, which provides that any person who performs an abortion is guilty of a felony. That is an unenforced abortion ban in our state statutes currently on the books. That will go into effect if Roe v. Wade is overturned. The only exception is if the procedure is necessary to save the mother's life. No exception exists for rape or incest. That will be on the books, as we say, as essentially a total ban on abortion in Wisconsin if Roe is overturned. Various district attorneys are saying things, or we can speculate about whether they will enforce such ban. The current attorney general of our state, Josh Call, has stated that his office will not enforce the abortion ban. But in Wisconsin, district attorneys may prosecute individuals for death acts committed in another county, which means that if a woman travels to another county for an abortion, a county where the DA is not enforcing the abortion ban, and returns to her home in a county that is enforcing the ban, the home county DA could nevertheless prosecute the person who performed the procedure. We are coming up on a break, and we will see you on the other side with Mandy. Paul Revere's show. Second half of the show, we're featuring Wisconsin Lieutenant Governor Mandela Barnes and candidate for United States Senate, Democratic candidate for United States Senate, Mandela Barnes. This is Craig Mastantuno, sitting in for Mark Thompson, regular host of the Paul Revere show. Lieutenant Governor Barnes, welcome.
Hey, man. Thanks so much for having me, Craig. Good to see you.
Good to see you, too. It's good to have you. I know you weren't. You were coming from another obligation. During the first half of our show, we were discussing women's reproductive rights, and you know, the sense of fear and doom that many on the progressive side have, given what is likely to be a decision by the United States Supreme Court, if not explicitly overturning Roe versus Wade, severely damaging it at the very least, in my opinion, about what's to come. And the theme that we were talking about is people's trust in our institutions following a momentous decision that takes away people's rights rather than endows people with expanded rights. So I want to return to that. Keep that in mind as we talk, because I really want to hear your thoughts on that theme. But I do want to invite you to introduce yourself to our listeners on the Paul Revere Show. I know you've been on with Mike Crude. I know you've also been on other shows on this station. Earl Ingram, I think you've been on with Earl, but I'd love for you to introduce yourself to our listeners. And let me just begin you by saying on the second national holiday for Juneteenth, happy Juneteenth. And maybe you could work that into your comments about where you grew up and how you grew up.
Absolutely. Having me, Mandela Barnes, probably serving as 45th Lieutenant Governor of the great state of Wisconsin. And I'm running for every person in the state has a fair shot at the American dream. It's about rebuilding the middle class that I was born in, same middle class that gave me so many opportunities. Also understanding the struggles of working people, having had shared those struggles with working people. And we're getting all over the place. Satan, we're talking about the issues that matter. We are dispelling the myth of the rural divide. You know, people want the same things. The schools send their children to, people want to be able to go to see a doctor with worrying about a surprise bill, and people have to put food on the table. And I'm really proud of the direction that the campaign has been going so far, the grassroots nation that we've built, well over 100,000 into this campaign, the endorsements of about 140 elected officials all across the state in every part of the state, from federal level down to the level, starting with our Congresswoman Gwen Moore and other leaders, of La Crosse, Mitch Reynolds, mayor of Wausau, Eddie Rosenberg, and the mayor superior, Jim Payne. So I'm really excited about the direction we're headed, and I'm also excited about the work that's to come.
Mandela, I've known you for years, and I'm a trial lawyer, and I'm always impressed with your ability to get a lot out with the time that you have verbally. But I can tell you've been on the road, my friend. You are in mid-campaign form right now, which means that was a lot. Let me try to break down some of it. And let me just jump right into the discussion we were previously having, because it's my impression that young people in those rural areas that you mentioned are also concerned about women's reproductive rights. Or do you have a different impression about that?
No, I have that exact impression, but honestly, there are people in, you know, general that preceded my own who've had to deal with these things already. And the fact to relive this all over again, incredibly maddening, is incredibly frustrating. I share that anger. I share that frustration. It's absurd that we're at this point. And this is a decision that will cost people their lives. Make about it. This is a decision about taking away people's rights. And it doesn't, for anybody who's out of this issue, because there is a wrong and a right side of this issue. People who are on the wrong side of this issue, it doesn't stop with Roe. It doesn't. This is about privacy issues, concerns at large. It's so much more to unpack. And Republicans will stop at nothing until no exceptions. And there's no excuse for the inaction we see in Congress. And that's why it's important to abolish the filibuster. And I can tell you right now, in the U.S. Senate, I'll never see procedures stand in the way of our basic rights, whether it's abortion access or the right to vote. People deserve elected leaders who are going to go to the mat to protect our basic freedoms. That's what I intend to do.
Well, my next question was going to be, what does a U.S. Senator, a Democratic U.S. Senator, do in response to that? And I think you just answered that question. And I just saw something in the news about you. Was it your shirt at Juneteenth parade? Was it Abolish the Filibuster?
Abolish the Filibuster shirt. You can go to store.mandelabarn.com to pick up one.
Okay. Well, so was that did the Dobbs issue help bring you to that stance, or were you there already?
No, I was there already. I think we had those shirts before that, the leak memo. Honestly, you look at issues like voting rights, which is, I mean, topic du jour every day, actually, not just the topic of the day, as always. Of the day. The fact is, we can't get anything done, it seems like, of consequence without a 60 vote margin.
We have minority rule.
Say it again?
We have minority rule right now in our country, effectively.
Well, the U.S. Senate, in and of itself, is effectively a gerrymander. It promotes minority rule. And we can also talk about the fact that members of the Supreme Court were put in place by presidents who did not win the popular vote. Of affairs right now in the filibuster, least we can do.
Absolutely. Well, let me get back to the first question I asked you a little bit ago about your own personal upbringing. I know one of the things I like about you as a public leader is that you're a product of the city that I live in, that you have lived a life that I think is exemplary of so many of the people that grow up in our city, and a product of our schools. So tell me how that informs your values and why that makes you uniquely suited for public office and a place in the United States Senate.
Well, I'll tell you, the U.S. Senate is one of the most disconnected places in the world. It's a millionaire's club. I'm running to break it up. The majority of people in this country, billionaires. The
Paul Revere Show. Welcome back. Craig Mastantuno sitting in for Mark Thompson with Lieutenant Governor Mandela Barnes and United States Senate candidate. A little bit of an abrupt break there, Lieutenant Governor. So I think you were in the middle of telling us a bit about your personal story and the Millionaires Club that you perceive to be the United States Senate at this point.
Well, exactly. And it's a perception. I mean, it's the reality, and it's the reason why things aren't should right now. It's the reason why the concerns of a majority of Americans are have yet to be met. We need a Senate that understands what we're going through. You know, I share people's fears and their struggles, but also hopes and dreams. I do believe that better change until we change the people we send them. That's the exact reason why I'm running.
All right. Tell me a little bit about the kind of the presumptions that we make as politicos and voters about, you know, you've got Milwaukee and Madison, and then you've got rural Wisconsin. And I think part of your campaign effort has been to kind of break that down a little bit, at least that perception, and reach voters across the state. And what insights have you gained running all over, as you have for some time now, campaigning for the United States Senate?
I'll tell you, that's been my approach even before I decided to run for the U.S. Senate. In fact, it's the reason why I ran for U.S. Senate. My very first year as lieutenant governor, very deliberately, very intentionally got to all 70 counties. I wanted to be sure that people knew that we were there for everybody. Administration that was prepared to take on the challenge, but also to build bridges, have conversations. When I'm in rural communities, I the issues in Milwaukee. When I'm in Milwaukee, I talk rural issues because it's important for us to have that understanding so that there is less fear, less division. I tell you, Republicans have used every opportunity to use fissures that exist currently. And in fact, they're the gaps, the chasms that the Republican Party is handmade themselves. And it's work to break them down, honestly. You know, a lot of people say, you know, can you win in rural Wisconsin? I say, well, absolutely. I'll also say that, you know, while we may in every county, you know, just being realistic about the situation, you know, nobody's matched Barack Obama, who won, you know, 34 out of 72 counties. Nobody's come even close. But the fact is, we at least have to start making significant gains. We at least have to start talking about the issues that impact rural communities. Because we can't leave people behind. That's what Republicans do. Republicans, people like Ron Johnson, have left people behind. People are struggling, whether it's in my hometown of Milwaukee, in the community, in the neighborhood, or people out in Cashton, or people all the way up in Bayfield or Ashland. All these communities that have been ill representation that they've been getting by so many Republicans. And another thing, I guess I'll say the last thing that's so evident is the fact that the people, whether it's, you know, doing as lieutenant governor or even during the campaign, it's not always about left or right, red or blue. At the time, we've been left at the bottom.
Yeah. You know, a couple things about your remarks. You know, as I said, the perception is, you know, urban versus rural. I think you make a very good case that the Republicans drive that war, not the Democrats. And that, you know, been pitting basically the rest of the state against our city, the city you and I live in, Milwaukee, for two decades at the very least at this point. And we've had to live through that. And I don't know if you remember this the same way that I do, but it seemed like when Governor Walker really began his assault on Milwaukee is when people in our city started acting as if, you know, we got to defend ourselves. We're at war. We're proud to live in Milwaukee. We're proud to be a city, the city that we are. And we need to stick together because, you know, basically somebody's trying to kill us as a city. And so, you know, I think that people on the Democratic side, like yourself, try to take down that debate and attack it right at its core to say this divide shouldn't exist. People are paying too much for gas, but they're worried about their reproductive rights. They're having trouble making ends meet all across the state, whether you live in the city of Milwaukee or in Ashland.
Well, I think you're exactly right. And, you know, although this is Republicans' problem that they created, sometimes it's a trap that's too easy for us to fall into. And rural Democrats, they still also feel left behind. I mean, they've been alarmed for a long time, and we got to stop them. But in order for us to build a stronger state, a stronger society, we have to talk about the issues that matter. And all of this is circular. Now, I think about some of the challenges we're dealing with in areas like Milwaukee with food deserts, food insecurity. The fact is, we have the second most organic farm in Wisconsin. And you think about the gaps that exist, and it is literally serving and out because of it. I'll tell you, like, when I meet with people, you know, there's not like there's this Milwaukee animosity. However, sometimes there is this thought that Milwaukee and Madison get a lot of resources, which we all know is not the case. Everybody's been starved, but that's what happens when you have that, when you have people in office who don't truly the people that they are to. People start blaming each other. Who's really been at fault here? You know, a lot of times, well, the person we want to get in office is, it'll be great. We'll forget about it until the next election cycle. Or the gets in office and we say, oh, well, we'll just get them next time. But people accountable in the meantime. You know, we have to keep who's in office.
Yeah, you know, interesting. A couple of things. You brought up President Obama earlier, and you know his record. You said 34 counties that he won when he was able to take Wisconsin in apparently one of his two elections, and took Wisconsin in both, but the 34 counties. And it wasn't it President Obama that also said, look, you've got to go to rural areas because, you know, you might not win that county, but you're not going to lose it 75-25 if you go there and connect with people and you come away with a 55-45 or a 60-40 spread rather than getting slaughtered in that county. And it seems like you're embracing that approach and you're trying to connect with people in those areas. Maybe you might not take the county, but you're going to earn respect and win votes in those counties. And as we know, you don't win to the Senate primary or the general election by the number of counties you win, but by the number of votes that you win, right?
You're absolutely right. And I'll tell you again, there's so much more that we have in common with each other than we do with any out of touch millionaire politicians like Ron Johnson. And it was Barack Obama's DNC speech in 2004. I'm glad you kind of went on about strategy of showing up in rural communities saying, hey, 75-25. And when I heard that speech, I was inspired. I was encouraged. I felt like the things around me could change. And it really made me think about all the common issues, all the common challenges that we're facing at the same time, but not together.
Yeah, that, you know, one of the things that frustrates me as a lifelong Democrat, and I was just as inspired by that speech, I don't feel like we play divide and conquer politics on the Democratic side. I just don't. I don't think we try to tell people school teachers have better benefits than you, so you should hate on them. Or, you know, unions are driving up labor prices, so you're paying more for a car. And I just think that's a game that we can fall into if we're playing small ball and losing sight of the growing issue in this country, which is wealth inequality. And people missing out on the American dream.
I'm glad you brought up wealth inequality. Over the course of this pandemic, you know, billionaire wealth increased an additional dollars. And at the same time, up to 7 million people in this country found themselves in poverty for the first time.
Unbelievable. Yeah. We, you know, none of my grandparents spoke English for a first language. You know, they emigrated from Italy and Mexico, and my mother came here from Mexico as an immigrant, and I'm first generation. And, you know, you start to wonder, are we reaching that generation that doesn't have a chance to do what we always thought is the American dream, which is every generation does better, right? And do you see that as threatened like I do?
Oh, see it, experiencing it. My grandfather was in Milwaukee after World War II. He was in the Navy and right away as a union steelworker at A.O. Smith. And, you know, that's a similar story to so many other people. But those doors of opportunity, those tickets to middle class, they're in short supply these days. And of growing inequality, ballooning inequality, the people at the very top, the very bottom, that class is, fortunately. And what that means is the middle class is shrinking and we are dealing with a whole host of issues because of it. It's harder to afford a school. It's harder to purchase a home. It's harder to do almost anything these days. The gas pump, the grocery store, you name it, the middle class to face because the level of greed that exists here in this country. And that's something we have to break power structures. What we need experience in Congress to make the decisions that'll positively impact quality of life for working people.
Lieutenant Governor, I believe that, well, first of all, you've been the front runner in polling in the Democratic primary for Senate. And I believe, knowing you and knowing your talents, that you believe you are going to be the candidate for Senate from the Democratic side in the general election in November. So if we can put ourselves past the August primary and you are on the Democratic slate of candidates, what do you think this election is going to come down to at the statewide office holders level and at in Wisconsin and at the Senate level for Democrats to prevail in November?
We are working hard. We're working like we're 10 points down because there's still an election in November. It's, can't go into this thing being lazy. So we are working as we can, covering as many bases as we possibly can.
Are we receiving, Evan?
Are you still there, Mandela? I saw his connection was having kind of a rough time. He was having the red bars.
Well, I hope we see that. Well, let's assume that Lieutenant Governor Barnes can hear us and he can work himself back in. And let's continue the conversation while we do that. And Evan, you'll give me a heads up if Lieutenant Governor Barnes comes back in.
Yeah.
I think that the themes that Lieutenant Governor Barnes and U.S. Senate candidate was invoking. Mandela, you there?
Yeah, I'm there. What just happened?
I think that was on your end. We just lost you for a moment.
Oh, sorry.
My apologies. So we've got about a minute and a half left, and you were talking about working hard to get through August, of course.
Exactly. Certainly not taking anything for granted here. Working hard. Because there's still a broad coalition role for November. And what Democrats need to do is show up everywhere to build trust and credibility. We have to show up authentically all over this state. We have to connect with people around those kitchen table issues that matter. This isn't a battle of ideologies. That's not what most people are thinking about when they leave home and come back from work every day, if they are fortunate enough to even be able to go to that's where we are right now, showing up, talking to people, even for the people who don't agree with me. We're opening, we're sharing space. We're giving an opportunity for people to be heard because that's missing the most.
Yeah, I know that you are courageous and will talk to anybody about any issue and engage at any time. Lieutenant Governor, I've always appreciated that about you. And I know that you'll continue to fight for things that we as Democrats hold most dear. It sounds like we may be headed for a rough time with the Supreme Court decisions, but we all got to hang in there because we all do better when we all do better, as Paul Wellstone said, right?
Absolutely. Onward to fight another day.
All right. Well, thanks for joining us, Lieutenant Governor and U.S. Senate candidate Mandela Barnes. Look forward to having you another time. And this is Craig Mastantuono sitting in for Mark Thompson on the Paul Revere Show. Thanks for joining us, folks, and we'll see you next time.